They're housing horses, donkeys, chickens, and pigs, as well as cats, dogs, and parrots. And you can donate at www.nvadg.org or directly through their Facebook page at North Valley Animal Disaster Group.
It's a great group that mobilizes in an instant to move, you know, 50 horses, which if you think about it is a very hard task.
Completely volunteer, completely Butte County based, almost exclusively.
A bunch of great people. Non-Human Radio is made possible through the generous contributions of KZFR listeners like you. Many thanks to Sue Hildebrand for her engineering assistance and moral support. Stay tuned for Sue's show, The Real Issue, coming up next. She's staring at me right now. We're late.
This has been Non-Human Radio, a production of KZFR 90.1 FM Chico. The views and opinions expressed on this broadcast are those of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of KZFR, its board, its volunteers, or its staff.
Our theme music is Ready to Fall by Being an Activist, Rockers Rise Against. If you missed any portion of this show or you want to listen again about tofu, go to the archives at kzfr.org. This is Danny Toms and Jeannie Trezino signing off. Until next week, be different, be better, be kind.
And go vegan. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. their revolution starts right now. You're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. This is Sue Hildebrand, and The Real Issue is a public affairs talk show. We're here every Wednesday night from 6 until 7 p.m., and we can be heard live through the internet at kzfr.org. You can also listen to our archives right from the website. This edition of The Real Issue is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Mount Shasta Spring Water Company, serving the community for over two decades with natural spring water bottled at a private certified spring at the base of Mount Shasta. Mount Shasta Spring Water is available for home and office delivery by calling 800-922-6277. I'm going to offer tonight an interview I recorded earlier this morning. Tonight on The Real Issue, we will focus on the situation in North Korea. Within weeks of the 2016 presidential election, then-President Obama warned President-elect Trump of the North Korean nuclear threat. In response to the suggestion that the isolated nation would soon develop technology allowing it to send missiles to the United States, Trump tweeted in January that, quote, it won't happen. On July 4th, less than 2 weeks ago, North Korea did successfully launch a missile test that experts say could reach Alaska. In response to this test, the question of what to do about North Korea is again a top story, if you can look past the various Trump's family scandals. With the Trump administration's North Korean policy ostensibly a continuation of the Obama policy, it's difficult to know how grave the threat is currently and what the appropriate approach to North Korea is if we'd like to avoid a nuclear war. In a recent op-ed in the LA Times called Why Are We Afraid of North Korea?, Philip Yoon writes, quote, North Korea is a desperately poor country led by a desperately misguided regime. The threat North Korea poses is serious, but not an imminent one to the United States homeland. So let's not make things worse by scaring ourselves and adding to the risk of another Korean War, end quote. We spend the entire hour tonight talking about North Korea beyond the headlines, digging deeper into the history and even the motives of its leader. To talk about North Korea, Philip Yoon is on the phone from San Francisco. Philip Yoon is Executive Director and Chief Operating Officer of Plowshares Fund. Yoon has a long career researching and advising the government officials about North Korea, including as a presidential appointee at the U.S. Department of State, serving as senior advisor to Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs. During this time, he also worked as a senior advisor to two U.S. coordinators for North Korea policy, including former Secretary of Defense William Perry. I am happy to welcome you to The Real Issue, Philip Yoon.
Good evening. Happy to be here.
So give me just a quick rundown of what is the Plowshare Fund?
Oh, yeah. Happy to do that. I'm the Executive Director and Chief Operating Officer of Plowshares Fund. We are a public foundation. That means we raise money to give it away. Our mission is to reduce the threat and at some point eventually eliminate the threat of nuclear weapons. So as a result of that, we've been focusing a great deal on Iran. We did a lot of work related to the Iran deal that just came through, which we think is a huge breakthrough. We focus on North Korea, obviously, and we are working on various issues related to the budget and nuclear weapons budget. The United States has a significant number of weapons, and we feel that they're way too many. The United States and Russia combined have something like large weapons, something like around 3,000 to 4,000, and that's just way too many. We can always go down, and the less that we have, the safer we are. So that's what we do. We give away something. We've given away in our 30-year existence something like over $100 million in grants. So we're a grant-making foundation, give it away to folks to work on really interesting issues, and we're kind of a venture fund to some degree. We try to get the smartest people with the best ideas, and we try to give them some initial seed money to see what can happen.
And you are a nonpartisan organization, and the final goal is ultimately the elimination of nuclear weapons.
Correct. We are a nonprofit. We are nonpartisan. We criticize administrations freely. We're about policies and not presidents.
And so, great. Philip Yoon, I want to ask you to set the tone of our conversation tonight. I think the general assumptions about North Korea these days is that, first of all,
President Kim Jong-un is simply crazy, and therefore reasoned approaches is futile. And then, you know, number two, China can and should be addressing the nuclear threat. And we'll talk about China, you know, later on in China's recent pushback to the assumption. So, Philip Yoon, give us an overview of how the U.S. And really the global community should be thinking about North Korea. What are some of the missing factors in the conversation?
Well, I'm glad you quoted my op-ed at the very beginning, because I do really think that's the gist of it. I think what's going on right now is that for many years, people have either treated North Korea as a joke or some kind of supervillain, depending on what the circumstances are, and it's actually neither. It's somewhere in between. What we've been doing, though, has been not taking seriously the threat that North Korea does represent, its capabilities. And for almost 15, 16 years, both Republican and Democratic administrations have failed to deal with North Korea, I think, in a straightforward way. And essentially what they've done is kick the can down the road. So what we have here is a North Korea that has the possibility and capabilities that are quite serious and potentially can, as you said, probably more like in the mid to, you know, 2020s, if they continue as they are in the current policy, will have the capability of hitting the United States mainland. They'll have a small nuclear arsenal. It is a serious threat. It's something we have to take seriously that we haven't done. It hasn't been a high priority. At the same time, I think that what's happening is this press, because of the fear of the unknown, because the North Koreans are so idiosyncratic, so odd, so strange, so unpredictable, we're kind of scaring ourselves. And so we are, I think, afraid of North Korea in a way that I don't think is justified. One of the things that I talked about in the op-ed was one of the things that's being lost out of all the discussion is the idea of deterrence. And I can tell you why I believe the North Koreans are incredibly rational, with a really bad hand, with them being an incredibly poor country. They've been able to manipulate China, the United States, Russia, South Korea and others to maintaining their regime. And so, therefore, they're quite rational. And the North Koreans know that if they attempted to do any kind of preemptive attack on any large scale towards the United States or South Korea or Japan, they'd cease to exist. So they're not suicidal. And so, therefore, we need to understand that they're not going to do anything unless they're threatened or unless they feel like they have no other choice. So that's the main thing. Related to China, the thing that I say about China is that we've tried this before. The current administration right now has essentially tried to farm it out to China. And I've been saying all along, for a variety of reasons, that it's just not going to work. We tried that policy in the early 2000s. The Bush administration tried to do it. They said, no, China would never allow North Korea to go nuclear. And in fact, that was wrong. And I think for reasons that we can talk about later, I think that depending on China is a huge mistake. It didn't work then, and it's not going to work now.
And there are so many things that I'm excited to talk with you about. Going deeper into China is exactly one of them. Philip Yoon, you know, one of the things that you mentioned is that North Korea is not suicidal, suggesting that they are rational, there are reasons, and if they feel threatened, that's what we should be concerned about. But the idea that they are very publicly and really celebrating the capability of hitting the United States, based on what you just said, suggests that they are feeling threatened. How is North Korea feeling threatened right now?
So the way that I would describe this is that if you, and again, I'm not saying I agree with how the North Koreans view this. I mean, you can look at a glass that's half empty or half full. But from the North Korean perspective, I think them having nuclear weapons, them spending a huge amount of their resource, is a perfectly rational choice. And so I'll tell you, it's for three reasons. So strategically, North Koreans, the ultimate objective for North Korea and the leadership is regime survival. I think most everyone will agree to that. So when they look at regime survival as the ultimate goal, there are three sort of intermediate objectives that they have. The first one is to prevent them from being attacked and to be able to protect their homeland, protect themselves from intimidation. The second thing the North Koreans are another priority is for them to, they have this myth about them being the chosen people, that their system of government is very superior, and this whole notion of being special, exceptionalism in their own way. And so, and then there's the third thing, which is relatively new, is that they've got to provide for their people. The economy is in shambles. They're one of the poorest countries in the world. And at the very least, they got to provide for, I guess, the elite people who within the center in Pyongyang who basically make the government run. So they've got to be able to show their people that they're going to improve their economic circumstances. If you look at it, nuclear weapons actually enhances all three of those particular objectives, intermediate objectives. The first is that nuclear weapons is essentially a poor man's weapon. They are afraid of attack. They keep on saying that we have more to fear from the United States, China, Japan, because they've invaded Korea in their 100, 200-year history, and rather than North Korea attacking anybody. And so if you look at their economy, which is in shambles, their military equipment is deteriorating. There was a study done by a well-known think tank that basically said their equipment is outdated and essentially very, very old. So when you have, and I've been there, I've been to North Korea four times, and I met Kim Jong-il, and you see these the equipment, and it's old, and it's deteriorating. So if they, that for them, a nuclear weapon is basically the ultimate weapon that protects them. They said, if you invade us, we will blow this up, and it's a deterrence for them. And when I was in negotiations with them, they said to me, look, if Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons, if Omar Gaddafi had nuclear weapons, if Vladimir Milosevic had nuclear weapons in New Yugoslavia, do you think they would still be in power? They say, we believe that's the case. So for them, it's a relatively small investment to produce, to protect them. So that's one rationale for it. The second thing, as I said, about sort of their national myth, they have put so much, literally, probably blood, sweat, and tears and money into this program that it's part of their whole ethos. And so by them being part of the nuclear club, only nine other countries are part of the nuclear weapons club. And so that's something that they tout. It's something that they view as an accomplishment. It is a technical accomplishment in many respects. And they've done an incredible amount with very few resources. And, you know, that's a tribute to their ingenuity. Unfortunately, it's in the wrong direction. But they can point to South Korea in the propaganda wars and say, well, South Korea doesn't have a nuclear weapon. And we're on par with the United States, China, and Russia. And so that's why nuclear weapons helps them. And the third is economic. And what they've decided is that for them, in order for them to work on the economy, they have to make sure that they're secure, that no one is going to mess around with them or threaten them. So there's precedent for creating security to allow economics to happen. So at the end of World War II, the United States said to a lot of the countries in East Asia when we're battling communism, don't worry about your defenses. The United States will take care of that. You concentrate and put all your resources in developing the economy. So that's what South Korea did. That's what Japan did. That's what the Philippines did. A lot of these countries went ahead and did that, and it worked. And so you also think about China. China, after it had nuclear weapons, decided that it had to make a transition, and Deng Xiaoping in the late 70s basically said, okay, we have to transition to a new kind of economy. We feel secure, and we are going to take a lot of the military, a lot of the resources we devoted to the military to focus on the economy. So that's what they're doing. Kim Jong-un, very interestingly, one of his first public statements in April, when he joined, I think it was 2012, I can't remember exactly, but his first public statement said, made the economy a really big thing. So from that standpoint, very rational, very calculated, and from that perspective, I think it's an argument for why North Korea wants to have these weapons, despite how poor they are.
And Philip Yoon, you have just cleared up so much for me in those, you know, in that pretty quick answer. But I want to just remind listeners, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. I have the executive director of Plowshares Fund, Philip Yoon, who the reason that he's on the air with me tonight is because just a wonderful, very short, very succinct op-ed piece in the LA Times. It's called Why Are We Afraid of North Korea? Philip Yoon, those three goals, those pretty rational goals, if you if you understand what people believe, then you can understand the rationale. And the interesting part for me, they want to regime survival. They are the chosen people, and the government needs to provide for the people. It seems to me that the current U.S. strategy towards addressing the growing nuclear threat from North Korea is exactly wrong. Because if they're worried about regime survival, and we, for example, during the 2016 presidential campaign, candidate Trump suggested assassinating Kim. So he's only playing into their fears, and then providing for the people. Our biggest strategy in the global community is more economic sanctions. And so
right.
It seems that what we're doing is feeding into the fear, resulting in a more desire for nuclear weapons.
So, yes, I think that's part of it. Now, the way I look at it is the Trump administration, in terms of what they're doing, there are a couple things that I do agree with, but it has to be part of a larger strategy, which I'm not sure actually exists. So that's why there's a problem here. First of all, this whole notion of beefing up our military capabilities in a preventive way, I think, makes sense. So it's the whole notion of making our deterrence capabilities strong and making sure that the North Koreans understand if they attacked us, they would cease to exist. I think that's very important, and I think that's an aspect of what they're doing now. I have quibbles about how they've done it to make it less threatening but more defensive.
Can you give us real specifics on that before you move on?
Well, I think one would be, do you need to publicize and talk about decapitation exercises and regime? You know, they have these military exercises that occurred this past February, which the North Koreans absolutely hate.
Right.
And so what they've put to great publicity is the capability of going in and taking out the regime. They call them decapitation exercises. You may want to have those, fine, but it's not something you want to give a lot of publicity to, and that just sort of raises that's just very provocative. You got Donald Trump's tweets, which you have the president in certain ways threatening North Korea in a way that no other president has done. And so that is something. And then when you talk about sending an aircraft carrier and make a big deal out of it, who knows what that means? So those are great examples. I think that doing and enhancing your deterrence and showing strength, I think, is absolutely fine. One of the things that you can do is that North Koreans, I bet, are very clearly watching through satellite if we are, in fact, getting ready for a full-scale invasion. That's what they're afraid of. If an invasion is going to occur, from their perspective, it's going to occur during these military exercises. So there are things that you can do to show the North Koreans this is not actually happening. So, for example, if you're going to do a full-scale invasion, again, if, you've got logistic lines that have to be done. So you just make sure that troops and logistics are separate from some of the other things that you're doing to make clear that this is just an exercise.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. So that's the deterrence piece of this. The second thing is I think sanctions are actually good. That's something that we need to do. I think you need to put pressure. But it has to be combined. So you're using sticks, but you have to combine them with carrots. And this is what's missing. So essentially what China has been doing is China has been playing good cop in this whole for the last several years. The United States, South Korea, and Japan have been playing bad cop. Now, good cop and bad cop work really well if you're working together, you're coordinated, and you have a common goal. It's terrible if you're working against each other, and that's essentially what's going on. And North Korea, in that gap, is able to drive literally, is driving, shooting a missile through that gap because we can't get our act together. So what has to happen, in a sense, is what you're talking about, what you just mentioned. So I told you three things that why North Korea feels like it wants to have nuclear weapons. So what you do then is essentially you have to give them meaningful, what we call security assurances. Say that, we're not about regime change. We recognize your right to exist. There's got to be, the regime, let me just say, is abhorrent, human rights abuses, misguided in so many different ways, but there's got to be some political legitimization there in their minds that they want from the United States that we can give within our bounds. And the final thing is figuring out a way for them to get access to the international economic system so they can actually provide for their people because, the vast majority of their people are suffering a great deal.
And Philip Yoon, you're just like sort of blowing my mind because you're saying everything I want to know, but not in the order I was ready to receive it. So I'm
okay.
I'm sorry. That's okay. It's certainly, you know, don't change anything. I'm just trying to catch up with you. So one of the interesting things that came to me is as you were talking, you said what you believe. We need this deterrence, but it doesn't need to be as public. And I think. What's true through most Asian nations is that there's a sense of saving face. It's about honor. And I think to keep deterrence on the down low and not publicize it is exactly contrary to what President Trump tends to do and many believe personally needs, is to be very vocal and to be very bigger than life sort of character. And the other part is the good cop, bad cop, where what I think you're suggesting is that the U.S. should be working in partnership with China, whereas we've seen recently President Trump turning on China to say, you're not doing enough. And so I'm wondering if it's really a moment where our lack of appropriate leadership is a real problem here.
Well, let me just say that the real danger, and this is something that I've been telling to people, is I'm not worried right now so much about a preemptive nuclear strike by North Korea on the United States. I think that's like non-existent, you know, incredibly remote possibly for the reasons why I described. I'm
right.
not worried about that. What I am worried about in this context is miscalculation.
Okay.
And this is the real problem that we have here. So you have, particularly during the April time period, you have all these military exercises that are going on between the United States and South Korea. So roughly what you had is something like 1.2 million North Korean troops. You had something like 400,000 South Korean troops. You had 30,000 U.S. troops in South Korea and about 50,000 troops in Japan, all with military, you know, the military assets that accompany that, all doing exercises. You then have a history of shooting across the DMZ where people are killed. You have the you've had a history of firefights in the West Sea, I'm sorry, between South Korean and North Korean naval vessels. You had a torpedoing of South Korean naval vessel where people were killed. And then you had all these missile tests that are going on. So, and then to top it off, and sort of touching on what you were mentioning, you have Kim Jong-un, who is young.
Mm-hmm.
He's had 5 years under his belt, but relatively inexperienced and have a long grooming time. He has a penchant for unpredictability, and he's quite aggressive. On the other hand, you have Donald Trump, as you described, who's very inexperienced in government, unpredictable, and very aggressive. So that's a bad mix.
Yes.
And at some point, mistakes can be made, and that's what I'm really worried about, is that if one of these missiles went off course and hit something by accident, what would we do? How would we react? What would others react? And you can see a situation where it escalates very quickly. So that's how I would respond to that. You know, China, if you want, we can talk a little bit more about.
Yes. Yes, I do. But I want to mention that if you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. I have Philip Yoon on the phone with me from San Francisco. He's the executive director of Plowshares Fund and really an expert on the North Korean situation. And so happy to have you here. I do want to, Philip Yoon, before we get into China, I do want to pull back for a minute and sort of put this in the larger historical context, which I think is often missed. We talk about North Korea every few years, and everybody freaks out, and we walk away still not realizing or understanding the larger context. So, as I mentioned to you earlier, before we got on the air, is that what baffles me about the situation is that North Korea is a relatively small country. It's very tiny.
Mm-hmm.
It's politically isolated, a totalitarian government, and with, as you mentioned, a very weak economy. Its people are very poor. what seems so inconsistent is that you said a nuclear arms program is a poor man's strategy. But give us a picture about what has happened since, I don't know, the Korean War. What sort of the path that North Korea has taken, particularly with respect to allying with the communists, with the Soviets?
So let me give you a little context here.
Sure.
On that. So again, North and South Korea were a product of really World War II. The occupation plan that was originally designed during the latter part of World War II, designed for Japan, was scrapped by MacArthur and actually more or less implemented in Korea. So then you had the Russians coming in during the height of the Cold War, backing Kim Il-sung. And the larger picture is that from an economic standpoint, North and South Korea were on rough parity with each other economically. And some would argue that in the late 50s, early 60s, North Korea was actually slightly ahead of South Korea economically, and economically more stronger, because North Korea was much more industrialized, South Korea is much more agrarian and more rural.
Okay.
So what had happened then is that through that period of time, it's also arguable that they were at rough parity, and then into close to the late 60s and early 70s, North Korea was, in fact, a little bit ahead. And then what happened, and they continued, and there was a lot of tension. So you had, again, height of the Cold War, China, to some degree, China, Russia, on one hand, backing North Korea, and the United States backing South Korea, along with Japan. Then what happens is that you had the collapse of... As a result of that, you had North Koreans who were constantly going. You had some early generation North Koreans who had seen Korea as one country. They knew Korea as not only they knew North Korea as part of the larger peninsula in one country, and also because of their relationships, they went out a fair amount. They went to all the communist bloc countries. There were a lot of relationships that were built during this time with the Chinese and the Russians. Then what happened is that you had a collapse of the Soviet Union, disintegration, and then the Soviet Union pulled out. Russia gave, basically essentially pulled out of North Korea and devastating their economy. South Korea, on the other hand, continued to make market changes, became a democracy, evolved, and became stronger, and was part of the, four Asian tigers, and their economy took off. And so then you had a huge... divergence between South Korea and North Korea economically during the latter 70s and early and during the 80s. And then that just came to a head in the 90s when North Korea was still trying to do this, and then you had this famine that was going on. Mm-hmm. Things were shutting down. And so what you had then is North Korea feeling weaker and weaker. Their allies deserted them. So China then recognized South Korea as well, and Russia recognized South Korea as well, and that was a huge caused a huge ruffle in relations, and then you had this huge famine in North Korea where, by some estimates, something like 1 to 2 million people actually died during the 1990s. And so then North Korea has gradually recovered from that. And, so that's the context. So North Korea views itself, again, they're very proud people, just like in, any other country.
Right.
Their economy and their ideology, they are quite proud of, which is one of self-reliance. I mean,
right.
The irony is they talk about self-reliance, but they've been relying on China and the Soviet Union. But this whole them is that they want to remain independent. This is part of their whole ideology, et
right.
cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So you come down to where the North Koreans are. Some of them are very resentful. Some of them know, and they blame the outside world for their demise. And it's not their fault; it's everyone else's fault. And as I said, if you look into the larger history, the Korean Peninsula, because it's strategically located, has been constantly a vassal state or invaded by China, Japan, and Russia.
Right.
So, again, that's part of their ethos as well.
Philip Yun, I do want to move into economy and the economic situation as it, and its connection to China. But before we move on, in your op-ed the other day, Why Are We Afraid of North Korea, you used the word misguided. You say it's a misguided regime. And I want to connect it to what candidate Trump said last year. He suggested that his approach to North Korea was to assassinate Kim Jong-un. And I want to ask you, besides the fact that it would be a violation of international law and, you know, very anti-democratic for the U.S. to do that, on the other hand, my question is it a matter of Kim Jong-un has a cult of personality, or is it a much bigger issue? Is it really a regime? Is it a nation? Is it a matter of one person guiding the future, or is it cultural?
So let me answer the question this way, is that no one really knows.
Okay.
So what I will say is that there is a lot of time spent on whether Kim Jong-un is really in power or is not, whether the regime has staying power or does not. So all I can say is that for many years, people have been predicting the collapse of the North Korean regime and the system. And in fact, that was one of the reasons why people kept on saying about Kim Jong-il, the father, that he wouldn't last. You know, he was a playboy, he was not very smart, and in fact, that was not the case. And so everyone said about Kim Jong-un, the grandson, the person in power now, that he would not last, has no experience. So I think to a certain point, yes, it is worthwhile to look to see if the regime is going to collapse or not going to collapse, and whether Kim Jong-un has staying power or doesn't. But at some point, one of the things, though, when it comes to leadership and the transitions and the dynamics, it is a black box.
Uh-huh.
We do not know. And it's very hard for us to make assessments one way or the other. I mean, the only American that has met Kim Jong-un, to my knowledge, is Dennis Rodman. So, you know, you can't really make any kind of assessments until you actually have the ability to sit down and talk with them. And that's one of the things that we were able to do when I was in government in the Clinton administration, is that there's a lot of discussion with Kim Jong-il. And I was with Madeleine Albright when she had meetings with him. And, you know, he was, he was not at all what people thought he was. I mean, he was very well informed and was not at all stupid that people had assumed. So, the thing that you have to look at this regime is, how does it act? What does it do? And there's an incredible consistency from one regime to the other and what they're doing here. And so what you see is that they're using the same kind of tactics, which is intimidation, threats, bluster, and strategically moving forward with their nuclear weapons and missile program. So that's the only way that I can answer that.
Right.
Now, that's
okay.
You know, one way to think about it is that certain things can line up in such a way that the regime is going to be threatened, but I just don't know what those would be.
Mm-hmm. And Philip Yun, before we jump into the economic aspect, I got to say, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. Philip Yun, let's talk about, you brought up the word collapse, and you know, I think one of the struggles, some of the various connections, the various issues that I want to sort of pull together and get your reaction to it is, you know, I one of the concerns of China and its approach to North Korea is that it does not want to see the regime collapse, because
mm-hmm.
what that would
right.
mean is, you know, we'd see refugees moving into China, and they certainly don't want that. On the other hand, the way that I'm thinking you would have that kind of a collapse is if we tighten the screws economically, and what President Trump is arguing is that China should be turning away from trade with North Korea. So talk about economics a bit and how that plays into this whole question of nuclear war and a nuclear weapons program in North Korea.
So The assumption is, let's start from the bigger picture. The assumption is that China and North Korea like each other and are friends. They are allies, but it's really a marriage of convenience and interest. The Chinese do not like the North Koreans, I will say, and the North Koreans do not like the Chinese. The Chinese are aghast at what the North Koreans are doing, and they feel like the North Koreans should listen to them more because the North Koreans do depend a significant amount on China for their economy, oil, energy, all of these things. The North Koreans, on the other hand, sort of laugh and scoff at that, to the surprise and befuddlement of the Chinese. The North Koreans would say, look, you know, we know that you don't like us. We don't like you. And we know the only reason you're supporting us and continue to support us is because it's in your interest to do so. So don't say you're doing us a favor when you're doing it for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially what the interest is, you pointed to some of that, but people have to remember that the Chinese had something like 600,000 casualties in the Korean War to prevent the United States from having a military position along their border at the Yalu River in Yalu River. That's why they invaded and came to North Korea's aid.
Okay.
So what has to happen, and what the United States, the issues between the United States and China are pretty significant. There's this whole notion and some theory and some people in both the United States and China who feel that China's the rising power, the United States, and I don't agree with this, the United States is the fading power, and so therefore there's going to be an inevitable conflict. And you see some of this overlap in the South China Sea about freedom of navigation, etc. And the Chinese feel that the United States wants to encircle them and contain them. So the key really is, even though the United States and China do agree that it would be best, and there's a goal to have a nuclear-free Korean Peninsula or nuclear-free North Korea, what they are disagreeing about is the priorities. For the Chinese, the bigger priority is status quo,
right. In
the sense that until they know what the U.S. intention is in East Asia and in the Korean Peninsula and the future of the Korean Peninsula, they don't want to do anything. And their priority is a non-nuclear North Korea is way down on the totem pole. For the United States, that's one of the top priorities we have. So there's an incongruity there. And so that's part of the issue that is going on. Until they can figure out what happens if North Korea does collapse, what's the future of the Korean Peninsula, what's the future of U.S. troops on the Korean Peninsula, that's what China wants to know. And before they will do anything at this point, they need to know what those answers are, and they have to be answers that they like.
Right.
So that's what's going on with them. So they will do stuff at the margins. But the sanctions that have actually existed to this point, they've said a lot of good things. They've done certain things. But the way that the Chinese have described it to me is, for the time being, their policy is we will not let the North Koreans starve, but we're not going to give them white rice either. White rice being the best rice that you can possibly have, right? So that's what they're going to do. And the Chinese also think that the North Koreans have shown such a capability of enduring hardship that they think that they don't want to create an enemy on their own border. There's always a possibility that North Korea is going to endure for a great period and a long period of time. So that's what they're afraid of.
Right.
And then let me also say that there is a larger priority here, and this does connect with the Chinese about its sanctions work, and I think this is something else that has been lost in the conversation.
Yep.
Let's say sanctions do work. Let's say China agrees with the United States, and we put bone-crushing, regime-crushing sanctions on North Korea. Well, it's one thing if North Korea 15 years ago, which is we were hoping to keep it at, had one or two nuclear weapons worth of material. Now they have 25. And in the next 5 years, they could have close to 50. Now, as we know, any kind of sanctions are going to take a long time to actually work.
Right.
So, but let's say that these sanctions really start working after 3-4 years, which would be minimum, I would think, if they work at all.
Uh-huh.
As we and So what happens? So there are two possibilities here. So now we have something like 30 or 40 nuclear weapons and material. Where is that? Where are they? They're scattered all over the country. So if I am a military guy who is worried about my children and my family, and they're starving or they're having a really tough time having food, and someone like Osama bin Laden comes up to me and offers me $5 million for something the size of a grapefruit, a plutonium or highly enriched uranium, which could take out a small city, what do you think I would do? Probably sell it, or at least the incentive is really high there. The second thing is, let's say the regime collapses. What happens to all that material? Now, the half-life, you know, when you produce that material, that's why it was so important for them not to produce it. Once you produce that material, you just can't throw it away in the garbage and say, don't worry about it.
Right.
You know, the plutonium has a half-life of 22,000 years and highly enriched uranium in the millions. So you've got to guard that. You have to secure that. So if North Korea collapses, there's going to be a mad rush to find that material by everybody. And once that material gets out of North Korea, and right now it's in North Korea and it's probably pretty secure, that material is going to find its way and blow up probably in the United States or Europe or Israel.
Philip Yoon, I have about 50 more questions for you, and I'm looking at the time, and so I'm trying to prioritize quickly. So much of what you said seems so clear, so rational, and it all makes sense. It seems like the U.S. needs to have some really smart, capable people in the administration. I know that there are many in the State Department. We need some advisors to President Trump. It doesn't seem like that message is getting through. What, you know, how do you see us moving forward? Is it a matter of we just have to wait till the next administration, or do you see some good work happening?
I think there's a possibility here. I mean, you know, I take at face value. Donald Trump says he's a deal maker. Well, here's the ideal opportunity to make a deal. Now, the key, so this is all about implementation. This could turn out into a disaster. It could actually work. So my hope, you know, I want this president to succeed, because if he succeeds in terms of how I define it, then the country will benefit from it.
Right.
So I think what has to happen, again, is if they're open to trying to figure out, I mean, ultimately what you need to do is get a freeze. That's the first step. I believe in a nuclear-free Korean Peninsula. I think that is something that's going to have to happen now. It's going to take a while for that to happen. North Korea is the land of lousy policy choices. It is one in which we cannot do a military strike on them. We cannot invade, because it would just cost, you know, untold amount of lives and conflict for another Korean War. If we keep on doing what we're doing, North Korea will have a small nuclear arsenal,
right,
that's capable of hitting the United States. And if we continue, or that's one thing, or as I said before, North Korea collapses and then there's the race to find out, you know, the race to get the material.
Right.
So the only option we've got really is to try to get a freeze to stop North Korea from getting the capability to hit the United States, at least in the short, you know, right now. That's the minimum thing we can do. Have them stop producing their nuclear weapons worth of material. They're producing one nuclear weapons worth of material every 8 weeks. Think about that.
Yep.
I mean, that's crazy. And then, again, you just don't throw that stuff away. So get them to just stop this right now. Just don't make it any worse. And then you try to figure out how do you make it better from there. And so that's what we have to do. And so part of this, then, part of my general discussion is that our policymakers, the senior policy people, have to understand North Korea better. You have to know who you're dealing with and not deal in stereotypes. And that was part of my exhortation in the op-ed that we were talking about, is you've got to know who you're dealing with and then adjust your approach accordingly.
Right. Philip Yoon, I think you're very kind to the current administration. I think a lot of folks are feeling sort of disheartened by a real lack of deal making, but regardless, I want to ask you, this is my very last question for you, mm-hmm. I promise, and
sure.
But I think it's kind of a big one. I want to allow you to be a direct advisor to the president, to the Secretary of State, you know, whatever. you mentioned some of the grand goals of the North Korean regime, and I want to ask you to turn that into sort of the reality on the ground. What kind of deal would you suggest that the U.S. administration engage in? And what I mean by that is, sort of along the way, you mentioned that Kim Jong-un is one of the most economically progressive leaders we've seen. Is it fair to say that as he's trying to provide for his people and even open up his economy, that he would be up for moving into a more capitalistic economic system? What does he want?
Well, it's unclear. So this is part of the issue, is that I don't know what the North Koreans want because we haven't had a conversation with them. So it's really hard for me to say one way or the other.
This is a recurring theme,
It's a recurring theme. You know, talks in themselves are not rewards. It's the ability to figure out what exactly it is that they need and what they want. I mean, so a lot of what I would say is speculation. Some people have thrown out the notion of the North Koreans hate these military exercises that we're doing. So I wouldn't say we cancel them, but we can certainly dial them back in a way that would make North Korea feel a little bit more secure. We would talk to them about giving security assurance or recognizing their right to exist or that we're not going to topple their regime. We've said that, right? But words are really hard. They want a peace treaty. We can do that. North Koreans want us to recognize them as a nuclear power. I don't, you know, that may be, you know, de facto they already are. That's a pretty big step for us, right? I don't know if that's something that they absolutely have to have. It's hard to say. You know, part of it is also access to the international community and benefits. So South Korea certainly has to be a party to all of this. And so getting them sort of ensconced in what is it they want to do. So my view is try to put more pressure, and by if you get China to agree, if you tell China you're interested in political solution, then China's going to probably be more willing to actually use harsher sanctions to get North Korea to the table, to get them to actually talk and actually make some concessions. So that's where I feel this is going. Now, it could be that none of this is going to work. And there's an argument, and I feel that there's an argument here. I mean, one of the things that I've been always worried about is North Korea has a number in mind. They want to have a nuclear deterrent. They want to have a number, X number of missiles. And they want to have the capability of hitting somewhere in the United States, okay? It doesn't have to be accurate.
Right.
But they want to have that. And once they do that, then they will go to the United States and South Korea and say, okay, we're ready to talk. We'll talk as equals. We're talking about arms control. You want us to cut back? We're willing to cut back significantly, but we're going to always maintain these until we're going to maintain these, and I would add, until we trust you, okay,
right.
Which is a long time coming. But that's where they're going for this. I want to stop at that. I want them to not get to that number that they're having. But there's an argument that says that when we negotiated with the Soviet Union in arms control is what they're talking about, and when I've met with them. Now, what we're talking about is disarmament, and disarmament is what a victor does to a vanquished.
So uh-huh.
That is not going to happen.
Sure.
If you talk about it in those terms.
Right.
So that's why they're talking about arms control, because you treat people as equals and you recognize the right for them to have them implicitly. So that's where they're going. My hope is that we can offer them or cut a deal now, at least to put everything on pause and not make it worse. And then we can figure out where to go from there.
And the
Go on. Yeah. So, in essence, again, let me just tell your listeners here is that the North Korea is a long way. This is several years before they're going to actually be able to hit the United States. So what if they have a missile that can actually hit Alaska? This is truly rocket science. I mean, they have to make something small enough to put on top of the missile. You got to be able to get it up there without it blowing up. You got to make it float in an orbit trajectory, and then you got to make it come down with all these G-forces so it doesn't explode either. So that's a lot of work that has to be done. So if we can get the North Koreans to just stop doing their testing, they're not going to know whether any of this is true. I mean, any of this is going to work. But, you know, for them, it may be enough deterrence where there's enough uncertainty related to this that they may be able to do this, that they're going to feel secure. I just don't know. But we don't know until we actually talk to them.
And are we really, this is my truly last question because I'm out of time, is are we not willing to, is the United States not willing to talk to North Korea, or is it North Korea that is not willing to talk to the United States?
Unclear. I think part of it is that we feel there are some people in the administration and others who feel that talking is a reward, particularly under these circumstances. And I recognize that. I mean, what they did to, for example, to Otto Wambier and the circumstances were absolutely appalling.
Right.
And North Korea has to be held accountable for that. And the way they've dealt with that has been equally appalling. So there are reasons why I can understand why they're reluctant to do this. But as I said, North Korea is a land of lousy policy options. At some point, you're going to have to hold your nose and you're going to have to engage with them because we've let them sort of continue on, and now it's to the point where we don't have a lot of choices.
Philip Yoon, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
And that was my interview from earlier today. I hope you enjoyed it. I learned so much from Philip Yoon. He is, as I mentioned earlier, the executive director of Plowshares Fund, and he's his latest op-ed is in the LA Times last week, I think. It's called Why Are We Afraid of North Korea? This brings us to the end of this edition of The Real Issue, which is made possible by generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by BCAC.TV, Butte County's public access television station broadcasting on Comcast Channel 11. BCAC.TV provides locally produced arts, culture, information, and entertainment from the heart of downtown Chico. They're located at 500 Main Street. At BCAC, there are daily broadcasts of Democracy Now, weekdays at 5 p.m. and 11 p.m. For more information or to get involved in BCAC, visit them at bcac.tv. We will be back next week, same time, and I'm going to go out with one of my very favorite David Bowie songs. If you want to like the Real Issue Facebook page, then you can participate in making suggestions, song suggestions. But you got to beware, because I usually do it at the very last minute, and I usually only give folks about 15 minutes warning. So until next week, peace out. When I look at my China girl.